This is All Things Considered on KNKX. I'm Ed Ronco. In Timothy Egan's new book, the Seattle author goes on a nearly 1,200-mile pilgrimage from Canterbury to Rome, from the seat of the Church of England to the epicenter of Roman Catholicism. Egan grew up Irish Catholic in Spokane, and he points to the church as being both a source of comfort and pain for his family. The pilgrimage, he writes in the early pages, was conceived as a way to, quote, force the issue to decide what I believe or admit what I don't. Timothy Egan, welcome.
Great to be with you, Ed. Thank you.
Glad you're here. First of all, tell us about this route you took and pronounce it for us. Via.
So this is a Via Francigena.
Okay.
And everybody knows about the Camino de Santiago, which is the better known pilgrimage trail. A million people a year take it. But this is actually an older one. It goes almost 1,200 miles, as you said, from Canterbury to Rome. And in the Middle Ages, a million people a year walked it. And the reason they walked it and risked death and exposure and being robbed was because if they got there, they'd have all their sins forgiven. That's why my book is called A Pilgrimage to Eternity. You guaranteed your place in heaven, essentially, if you could walk this route. And then it fell into obscurity, the mists of time, post-Reformation, and then the European Union revived it in the 1994. It gets about 40,000 people a year right now. It's a spectacular country. Hmm. It's just, I mean, I would walk it just for the variety of terrain, but it also goes through the theological cradle of Christianity. So it had a lot of things going for it from my perspective.
Your journey came after the death of your mother, Joan.
Yeah, so it was really hard. These things sometimes happen in a delayed way. My mother died a few years ago, and on her deathbed, she was very devout, progressive Catholic. We got all the liberal Catholic magazines around our house, and mother of seven, one right after the other. And on her deathbed, she expressed some doubt. She said, you know, I really don't know what's ahead. And I didn't really think about it much at the time because my faith was lapsed. But then as I pondered this pilgrimage, I could sort of hear her voice and her urging, you know, press this issue yourself. And I'd been sort of wading in the pool of agnosticism, like a lot of folks, because it's a nice pool. It's about 95 degrees with the jets always going. And, you know, it's comfortable. You don't ever have to think about these things. And I thought I would press these issues.
You, I'm guessing, sat next to your mother in Mass growing up. You looked to her as sort of a spiritual guide for some length of time. Was it surprising to hear her say, you know, that she had some doubt at the very end?
It really was, especially considering what happened to our family. The largest crisis in the Catholic Church right now, I say in 500 years since Martin Luther and the dawn of the Reformation, is the sexual abuse crisis of predatory priests. And this affected our family. One member of my family was affected by it and lost his best friend who killed himself as a result of this thing. And it really destroyed. We lived across the street from the church, and the priest was always welcome there. And I said I would never forgive them. I said, that's it. I will not forgive these bastards for what they did to my brother. My mother held on to her faith, though, which was very interesting because she'd had one or two genuinely spiritual moments in her life where she felt the presence of something greater than her. And I think she sort of intellectualized it, too. But then this doubt at the very end just completely threw me. I mean, a lifetime devout Catholic who had had spiritual moments, suddenly at the very end. Well, interesting, Ed, Mother Teresa said the same thing on her deathbed. She said she was praying, but she wasn't hearing anything in return.
Well, you also talk about your mother having, you know, on one hand, very moving, important experiences in her life that meant the church was a great source of comfort to her.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's a passage where you talk about her needing a hysterectomy to save her life and going and seeking the advice of the priest about that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked that question. It shows in microcosm the conflicts of the church itself. So on one hand, it can be soothing and comforting by practicing the biblical admonition to treat the least among you well and the admonition to comfort the afflicted. You know, my mother would go on these retreats that were free and she would come home. She would nearly have a nervous breakdown before she left. And she'd come home and she was a new person. On the other hand, after having 8 kids, because she lost one in a miscarriage, the doctor told her that she had to have a hysterectomy. And the priest and then later the bishop made her feel like it was a spiritual crime. And yet when you dial down on the sources I try to do in my deep walking of this pilgrimage, which is, you know, a term you hear from people as you're walking this trail 18 to 20 miles a day, as you dial down to it and go to the source, you see nothing at all in the Bible about all these restrictions on sex and how many kids you can have and birth control and, for that matter, homosexuality. All these things are concocted in the dogma that was dreamed up later, but has nothing to do with the basis of Christianity. So I saw two sides of it, the comforting and then the horrible guilt they tried to make her feel because she was having a life-saving operation.
My own mother talks a little bit about how she has deep love for the tradition, and she still attends the church she grew up in, you know, deep love for the tradition of the church and the things that she knows from her life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of anger is not quite the right word, but a lot of frustration with Rome.
Right.
And differentiating those two things, that there's my parish in my town, mm-hmm. and then there's Rome. There's
right.
the church with a capital C.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you can see a lot of that in France when you're walking the Via Francigena. France is a 97% Catholic country. They love the weddings and funerals part of it. They love, look what happened in Notre Dame burned. Mm-hmm. Macron said it was the heart of France. Mm-hmm. They love the ritual, but only 3% of them ever go to Mass. So that you see that love of faith and tradition in the past. Now, you sort of touched on something really interesting about that. Your mother's thought is probably how I was. You know, 50% of American Catholics are lapsed. But then along comes a Pope, Francis, who sort of, you know, he has the most famous papal shrug of all time when he talks about gays and he says, who am I to judge? Mm-hmm. He, instead of having people kiss his red slippered feet, he goes out and kisses the feet of the homeless, refugees, and hungry people, and Muslims. Completely throws out, you know, or seems to dismiss all the parts of the church that so many people have found so offensive and brings it back to its core. One of my quests in this journey, and I can't tell you for spoiler alert how it turns out, was to have an audience with the Pope. Mm-hmm. And it was twofold. It was, can I forgive him as someone whose family has suffered from this? And can I still find a faith in this Pope who I really believe in?
You've written 8 books before A Pilgrimage to Eternity. Is this the most personal?
It truly is. It's very hard to write. It's hard for me to write
yeah.
a very personal book because I can hide myself in the third person. And
there's that journalistic detachment,
right? Which I find very comforting
yeah.
because you don't show your cards. And I just lose myself in the details. When I wrote The Worst Hard Time, the book that won the National Book Award, I had fabulous stories. And I said, just get out of the way. Don't try to clutter it up with any fancy prose or anything. Just get out of the way and tell the story. This is somewhat similar to my very first book, The Good Rain, which a lot of Northwesterners know because it was an exploration of our history in the course of a journey. Mm-hmm. And that was written in the first person, but it wasn't as personal. In this one, I struggled with how much to tell. And I finally concluded, Ed, that if I was going to be honest with the reader about someone who's going on a faith journey, I had to tell them about my background, which includes the awful thing the church did to my family and also my mother's recovery through it. And then I had another tragedy as well. My sister's son was murdered. And it made me realize, you know, what kind of a benevolent God allows, you know, a wonderful family like that to lose a child.
Your reflections on faith and your family are interspersed throughout the history of Christianity in Europe, and it is a bloody and difficult history.
It really is. And I say near the end of the book, again, not trying to give away a spoiler, is that the durability of that history is not positive because it involves so many high crimes. But the starting of Christianity, the first 3 centuries, it's, as I say, a struggling spiritual startup that by all odds shouldn't have become the world's dominant faith. I mean, 50 years after the death of Christ, there were no more than 2,000 Christians in all the 50 million people of the Roman Empire. That's according to their census. Hmm. Now there's 2.3 billion people, and it's growing fast in Africa and China, where people are hearing this faith on a pod. So when it was a religion of love and tolerance, it was infectious, and they used to say how these Christians love one another. Women could be deacons. There wasn't all this hierarchical power. That was very, very positive. But then they make their original sin, to use the term, which is church and state join. And that starts when the Roman Empire not only legalized Christianity, but made it the state religion. It took about a century to go from legalization to outlawing all the old gods of the Roman Empire and the Greek Empire. And shortly thereafter, they're waging war against infidels. And those are just Christians who were heretical, too.
Because all of a sudden, the faith has become less about the things it was founded on and more about holding on to power and gaining more.
Exactly. It's an instrument of the state. And also, that's why I say, when I talk about the Enlightenment in this town where it's dedicated to this atheist philosopher, Denis Diderot, I talk about the pure genius of the American First Amendment,
right,
which was a rebellion against those 1,500 years of European joining of church and state.
You spell out your problem with Christianity in chapter 12 with a paragraph that begins, "The deeper you unravel the layers of this faith, the more trouble you find." Can I ask you to read the end of that paragraph?
So this is from a chapter about Napoleon, where I went to his boarding school. The chapter is called "Napoleon Was Bullied Here," which he was. "As for harnessing the gospel of Jesus into a vehicle of war, you can't just continue to explain that away. If it happened a couple of times, fine. Free will, bad judgment, cynical manipulation, the motivation of martyrdom, and all that. But this pattern repeats itself over and over. The Christian God in service of countless cruelties."
So, Timothy Egan, that passage from your book struck me because it feels like we're having so many of those same conversations today.
Yeah, one of the big complaints that young people have about religion right now, and they're the people who are dropping out in droves. I mean, 40% of millennials have no faith at all. They call them the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, is because they see evangelicals, for example, giving cover to a president who seems to be doing very unchristian-like things, putting children in cages, not allowing refugees in, lying daily, those kinds of things. And it really bothers people. They say, is this what religion is all about? That passage you asked me to read is what I talked about, the durability of this history not being good. That said, I came into this book very open-minded. I said, get rid of your skepticism. Get rid of your secular cynicism. Go into this thing as a true seeker. And I don't end on the side of all religion is bad. I mean, I'm encouraged by genuine people of faith that I saw along the way. I'm encouraged by the supernatural, which I have a chapter on miracles, and something happens to me on this trail which I can't explain, the inexplicable. And by the way, Christianity is tied up in the inexplicable, and religion by its very nature is inexplicable. So it's a balance of the one hand is the religion, the history of organized religion, it does not bode well. And that passage you had me read just shows that they used it time and again, and we're using it right now in our own country. You see people. But flip side, and I don't want your listeners to forget this, is that faith itself is something different, and the power of that faith and the power of that philosophy is something I will not trash.
I want to go back to your family, which you mentioned throughout the book. You talk about sexual abuse committed by the priest at the parish across the street from where you grew up, and you talk about your late sister-in-law, who at the time was dying of cancer.
Right.
And you ask what so many people have asked through the generations, which is, why would an all-powerful God let bad things happen?
Yeah, that's the toughest thing. So when I started this journey, I had on my Kindle Christopher Hitchens, the atheist philosopher who wrote a book called God Is Not Great.
And you cite him a lot throughout.
Right, and it's a great, I admire him. He's no longer with us, but he was a great polemicist. And he has this very strong screed against all religion. On the other hand, I had St. Augustine, who's considered the premier Christian philosopher, you know, wrote tomes that become institutionalized. So I sort of let them argue along the way. The one argument I couldn't ever get around was the one you just posed. Now, a lot of theologians have stopped thinking about this. They think, oh, that's only for, you know, 101 level. But I don't see how you can ponder the nature and existence of God without asking how that God could allow the Holocaust to happen. 6 million Jews killed, another 2 million killed. The genocide in Uganda, Cambodia, or even what AIDS does to people. I have a small little example. My daughter joins me at a part of the journey. And at one point, a dog attacks us. And we can't fend off this dog, and she gets bitten by this dog.
This is in Italy.
Yeah, this is in Italy, which is the most glorious part of the Via Francigena, where every ounce of land just seems stitched to magnificent, you know, mysticism. And people love on the VF. They just love seeing pilgrims on that part. And the French are like, yeah, you know. But the Italians really seem to love you. So she gets bitten by this dog, and, you know, I bandage her up, and we go to dinner later that night. I sort of pose this question from St. Augustine. His explanation was that, well, he gave us free will, and I don't want to put a gender on God. God gave us free will, and we screwed up. We make terrible mistakes. But I asked that question small scale on Sophie, my daughter. What did she do to deserve getting bitten by a dog? Did she make a bad judgment? No, we were walking along, a dog comes out of the blue and bites her. The same can be said about all those innocent victims. Extrapolate that to the millions of people who died, or for that matter, people who lose a loved one to something like Alzheimer's. Did they deserve that? The bad decision argument just doesn't hold up.
How were you changed when you came back? How did you approach life in Seattle differently having been on this pilgrimage?
Well, it's really hard to look at your routine the same after you come back from something like this. It's like one of those movies where someone goes through, you know, a life-changing event. They survive a drowning or something, and everyone's sort of living their lives, but in a different universe. So I had to come back in the middle of this. I broke it up into two parts because I got injured and I had some family things to tend to. So I went back and finished the Via Francigena. When I was home in Seattle, my mind was on the VF. I missed being a pilgrim. I missed the drama. I missed the surprise. I missed the daily searching and seeking. I missed all the companions I met. I missed all the adventure. My mind was over there. I'd finally broken down my ADD daily level thinking, which a lot of us have with our digital distractions. And I was able to sort through some things. So I really missed it. And I was a changed person. I still am. I mean, I'm not going to say, again, where I am. I mean, I don't fit myself into a slot. But I would say this pilgrimage is one of the best things I did.
Was it isolating at all? Because I know that your son joined you for part of the trip. Your daughter joined you for part of the trip. But you went on this journey yourself. You came back to people who haven't done that. And was there a sense of, you don't understand what I've just experienced?
You know, I tried to avoid that.
Yeah.
There was that. And it was isolating. I was really lonely for long stretches of them. I mean, the community of Santiago, you're always going to run into lots of people. On the VF, you have long, lonely stretches, and then you run into people and you don't necessarily want to walk with them. You may not like them even. I mean, that happened to me a couple of times. They were, oh, I'll just walk with you. And I was like, well, no.
Maybe not.
I got my own thing going here. You know, it's like I'd have to ditch them or say, no, you go ahead. I'm going to get a late start. Because, you know, it's one trail and you're going to see them. But it was isolating to answer your question in that you'd gone through a singular experience. I certainly don't think of myself on any higher moral plane or anything like that. I just think I did a rigorous triathlon of the soul.
Can you talk a little more about what you mean?
Yeah. So the way I prepared for this journey was to first get myself in physical shape, you know, running every day, going running stairs, getting all my body ready for this sort of thing. The harder part was preparing spiritually and personally. You know, I atoned, I gave a donation to charity, I told this guy I wanted to end the feud we were in, although he later said, were we in a feud? Completely ticked me off because he wouldn't even acknowledge my feud. That's the sort of starting of the rigorous triathlon of the soul. And then every day you're on the trail, or at least for me, people take different approaches to this. Every pilgrim is different. Every pilgrimage is different. I would try to say, today I'm going to think about this. So I would drill down on a certain question and go back and forth. I would listen to some stuff on my Kindle, but then I would just basically try to sort it out myself. That's the process of deep walking. And the triathlon part of it is when you push yourself. So we all are pretty complacent in our beliefs and thinking. And it's tough to get out of your complacency. So that's the triathlon part of it is when I would say, but if, I would try to take it to the second and third levels of it. And I, even though I didn't reach complete resolution on all of these, I did resolve a whole bunch of these questions, you know, about guilt and nature of sin and just and benevolent God and those sorts of things. And again, you could probably do this at home, but you would have to be in an isolated chamber or something. The pilgrimage forces this.
You're with your own thoughts the
whole
time.
You're with your own thoughts, which is a luxury.
You're not podcast. Yeah. You're not listening to a podcast.
It's absolute. I mean, I talk about this not being a rich person's trail, but that is a luxury in modern Western life. You put your finger on it to be with your own thoughts, and to be with your own thoughts at a second, a third, and a fourth tier, because we usually think about it at the first tier, and then we go off to another distraction. And I'm as guilty as anyone on that. I mean, I do have your basic daily ADD. I do have it. So the triathlon, the soul was difficult initially. And I'm way more difficult than the physical part of the Via Francigena.
Well, and like even when you're trying to clear your mind, you know, you think, okay, I'm going to sit here, I'm going to clear my mind, and then did I leave the iron on? And what's for dinner tonight? And where's my car parked? And you know,
right.
I mean,
right.
And so you have to kind of push through that.
And I got lost a lot. Well, enough. Because I didn't pay attention to those things you just described. I was so trying to clear my mind. I wasn't thinking, where am I going to stay? What am I going to have for dinner? You know, and the trail markings are kind of bad in France. They're good in Italy. So I would get lost because I would, I'd get so lost in my thoughts. And then I would also, to joining lost in my thoughts, would lost on the trail.
I think a lot of us who lead, you know, that kind of digital life full of distractions, and we're going about our daily routine that's full of this, that, and the other thing, hear you talk or read your book and think, how do I get that for myself? Mm-hmm. I can't necessarily fly to Europe. I can't take the time that he took. But are there ways, places we can go, metaphorical places we can go to kind of, you know.
Well, you know, it's funny because one of the things people seem to be responding to on this book is the idea of a digital cleanse, or, you know, everyone wants to go on a digital cleanse. Mm-hmm. They want to. I had a lot of trouble the first night I spent at a monastery. They asked this abbot, you know, is there Wi-Fi? Because I wanted to find out, you know, the latest Trump polls and the Mariner score and a whole bunch of usual useless crap. You know, I had real trouble with that.
He kind of just glared at you,
right,
if I remember.
Right. He really did. He almost threw me out because of that. After I survived this interrogation. That's a great question. I think the term that people use, and this is why it's so popular, is mindfulness, just to be aware of the present. I used to put that down as a millennial term, oh, your little mindfulness episode. But having been on a pilgrimage, that's what mindfulness is. It's just being present. There's a passage in the book where I talk about having a transcendent moment after I leave the monastery at 5 a.m. It's a glorious morning in France in the countryside, and I just feel like really joyous. I mean, I just feel happy. And I talk about there is no past. There is no future. There's only the present. There's only the moment. There's only now. That's what some people call mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you can, you do have to break your routine though. And for me, I had to literally leave the country. I will say this also, any pilgrimage, whether it's the Camino de Santiago, the Via Francigena, is not very expensive. The monasteries have to put you up. Most of the people I saw were teachers or students. There was a lot of young people on the trail. It's not a rich man or rich woman's trail. You know, you're not going to 5-star hotels and things like that. You got to get over there. But once you're on this, you can do some part of it. And people do 50 miles of it. They do 100 miles of it. I could think of my mother when she used to go on these retreats. She would like to do just a section of this.
You talk about how in her last days, your mother said she wasn't sure what's next. Mm-hmm. She was talking on a spiritual, eternal plane, but it seems that when you're on a pilgrimage, there's a smaller, more literal version of that question with you every day, and maybe the other one too.
Right, and that's one of the things I love, absolutely loved about the Via Francigena is every day there was going to be some mini quest of itself. I mean, just first of all, can I get over the mountain? You know, the 3,000 vertical feet I had to do in 18 miles, that becomes metaphorical for, can I get over the mountain of my feelings about why religion is used for so much evil? You know, why is so much murder committed in the name of God known as the Prince of Peace? Now, in my mother's case, it was interesting because, like a lot of people of faith, she really thought it through, and she was very well read. She read a book a week, and like I said, a progressive Catholic who just didn't stop thinking about these, kept thinking about these things at all time. So she assumed there was a afterlife for her, that she would start to feel it as she died. I held her hand as she fell in and out of life. That's when she said, "I'm not feeling it." It was a jolt to her, because she'd assumed most of her life that she knew what the next phase was. Mm-hmm. And to see it literally in her face, a person who's now in her 80s and had faith her whole life, was just a hard thing.
It's interesting because in Spokane, you were surrounded by Jesuits.
Right.
For whom doubt is a central tenet of faith, not an antagonist to it.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I went to this Jesuit high school. I would say 50% of the people who graduated from there were atheists by their senior year, because the Jesuits taught us to think for ourselves, and that's what we did.
Yeah.
So we became independent thinkers. And that's what's good. I mean, I think that shows up in the pilgrimage in that I'm not going to, my mother was different in this regard, but I'm not going to assume all these things because somebody told me them. I have to find them out myself.
Well, Timothy Egan, thank you for taking us along on your pilgrimage.
Thanks for having me.
Timothy Egan is a New York Times columnist and a New York Times bestselling author. He lives in Seattle, and his latest book is A Pilgrimage to Eternity.